So we're back on YouTube stream, and we're just waiting for Venerable Rabina. I'm just going to talk a little bit to make sure we don't get thrown off YouTube for lack of activity. Tom, I see you smiling. What's up with you? Say hi. So I'm not just sitting here talking to myself.
Hi, Donna. You're not talking to yourself.
Okay, good.
My wasps moved out, and I repaired my Buddha today.
Oh, wonderful. Good.
How about that?
That's fabulous. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Good to hear that.
Thanks for your advice, by the way.
Yeah. Well, now you know what to do in future.
Yes, well, sure. I'm sure my repair is temporary. So
yeah.
In the fall, I'll have to find a very tall tree with a good couple of branches that form a fork.
Hey, Donna, thanks for the crash course learning how to do all this stuff for us. This has been awesome.
Oh, thanks, Denise. Yeah, I feel a little bad when Venerable Bina says, help them, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know how. So thank you, John.
You did an amazing job. This is awesome.
I agree with that.
Isn't it amazing that with everything that's going on, we still have the karma, you know, around the world to have tools like Zoom and YouTube so that we can still hear the teachings, you know, even if the teacher can't physically come. That's an amazing blessing. So,
do you think this will continue even after we're allowed to be together again, if that ever happens?
This kind of Zooming?
The teachings, yes. This method, rather than going to a location.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we've always streamed teachings on YouTube. Everything, you know, almost everything we do, we stream on YouTube, which doesn't give you the immediacy of Zoom. And I know we're going to continue to use Zoom as a tool at Kadampa Center after this.
Okay.
For visiting teachers, you know, nothing beats having the teacher here physically. But I'm just really glad that we're able to have the teachings like this. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of cool about Zoom is that she's right there. You know, you're not 10, 20, 50 feet away in a room, you know, the teacher's right there. And here she is.
Yes.
Hi. Okay. Let's keep going.
Venerable, there was a question that came up after we broke up.
All right. Tell me.
A question about karma. If a family member has great suffering, mm-hmm. Is their suffering also your suffering karmically?
No, yours is not theirs. Everybody has their own, don't they? So it's very specific. You think of, you know, a group of people, mummy, daddy, family. I mean, everywhere we go, we're social. Like we're always connected to other people somehow. You know, ants have got families and dogs have groups and dogs have enemies and monkeys have friends. We're very social. Part of the major way our karma ripens as sentient beings is we interact with each other. And each sentient being has their own track of karma. So for example, let's say there's the child, and the child has cancer. So that's the karma of the child due to past killing, that they've got cancer. There's another child who, due to past generosity, won the lottery or got best prize in the something or other. So each of those children, that's their own particular experience based upon the actions they created. Then each of those children has a mother, let's say, and one mother, the mother of the good child, she's an alcoholic and she can't even see that her child is being successful, so she doesn't even think of anything because that's her particular suffering. And the other child, the one who's got a child who's sick, then she'll have suffering herself, but that's her suffering as a result of the interaction. But you can't, nobody can, I mean, you know, six people all playing the piano all helping each other, but my ability to play piano isn't because Robbie created the course to play piano. Each person's own experience comes from their own actions, and then we happen to have experiences together. But each of us has our own track of experiences, own track of karmic seeds, which means our own way of responding to each of the other things. Very specific. Just look into each individual's person and see what their experiences are, and it can tell you the karma. So, you know, for example, a mother might lose her baby. Well, the karma of the child is because of past killing. It dies young, but the mother It's the loss of, I mean, the break, the heartbreak of having, of a person leaving you, you know, and that's from some particular karma of yours. Everybody's got their own particular set of experiences, you know. Yeah. What else, people? No more questions there, Donna?
No, but can I just clarify a little bit from your answer just now?
Yes.
So you have your own karma, and you have the karma as the parent of the child with cancer to suffer because, to suffer from having an ill child. So basically the child is sort of like causes and conditions. You have your own karma, but you've got those conditions.
No, you see, the only way we're going to really understand this properly, Donna, is when we keep thinking, what are the main causes of my experiences? So the main cause of your experience isn't your suffering child. That's, your suffering is because of your attachment to that child and the loss and the sadness. That's your specific role in it. We're so used to thinking the external event. It is a condition, but it's not the main cause. And we want to think of the main causes. I mean, one mother might have a child who's sick, but she has no attachment to the child and she couldn't care. Everyone's different. So the external event is one thing. For me, my child dying is an external event for me. And for my child, their sickness is their internal event and how I respond to them is their external event. So each of us has got our own causes. The external event is the thing that triggers those causes. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, that makes sense.
Precise way to put it, yeah. What else, people? Anything about emptiness? We should go about emptiness more, perhaps. So we should... Maybe I'll read from Lamayashi's Mahamudra book. He is excited. Any questions, anybody? Anything you want to talk about?
I just want you to know that I'm here now.
Good on,
I
Andrea.
See you and I hear you.
Good, I'm very delighted. Finally.
Yes, me too. Yes.
I'm happy, Andre.
And I'm enjoying this.
I'm so glad. Do you have any questions, Andre? No questions?
Yeah. I have no questions, not at this point, no.
Okay, Andre, fantastic, darling. So let me talk about Lamayashi's Mahamudra book. There's two, in our tradition, there's two different ways of meditating on emptiness. And in general, you could say, in particular meditating on emptiness, but in general, concentration meditation and insight meditation aren't exclusively only for meditating on emptiness. They're taught in the six perfections in a very, the two modes of meditation are the fifth and sixth of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva. So technically, concentration meditation is not even a Buddhist technique. It's Hindu. The Buddha happily took it, you know. So, but it's a second scope teaching. It's a Hinayana teaching. It's a high school teaching. Because if you're on the Hinayana path, if you're on the Theravadin path, if you're going to graduate at high school, you need to junior school, control your body, control your speech, abide by the laws of karma. Then you go to the next level. You start to get some renunciation by learning to meditate, looking at your mind, giving up attachment, giving up anger. And then eventually you get concentration and eventually you meditate on emptiness and then you get liberation. And then you're out of here. You're gone, you know? So it's emptiness is actually a Hinayana technique, but it's taught in the Mahayana path in the framework of the final stages of the practice of the Bodhisattva. So the first level of practice we need to get is this, as they call it, renunciation. This, you know, controlling our body and speech and mind, having the discipline of a good practice, living in vows, purifying our karma, watching our mind, controlling our body and speech throughout the day, disciplining our lives, giving up attachment, giving up anger. This is the nuts and bolts of the wisdom wing practice, a person's own individual practice. That's practice. So then you go to the Mahayana level, you go to the compassion wing, and now you start to cultivate bodhicitta. And that's the next level of realization, the next kind of turning point. You get this amazing, as we mentioned briefly yesterday, you cultivate this amazing attitude of this paradigm shift in your mind based on incredible love and compassion for so many sentient beings, realizing they're all in the same boat as you, all suffering because of their own karma and all suffering because of their own crazy states of mind. You know, you then manifest this, then culminates as this extraordinary attitude that I'm never going to give up helping others, never going to give up working for others, and never give up life to life, becoming a Buddha so that I'm qualified to help them. That's the next level of realization. So the third level, as we know in these three principles, as we mentioned, this third kind of major shift, next shift, is to combine your bodhicitta with finishing the wisdom work. The wisdom work starts with karma and the mind, and now you finish that. In the six perfections, the first four are they really the perfecting of your work in relation to others? You bop around from life to life to life, perfecting, helping others, perfecting generosity, perfecting all those first four. And the last two in your meditation, you're perfecting your insight into ultimate reality, which is when you realize emptiness, which is what cuts the root of all this nonsense. So that's where the two modes of meditation are taught. You need concentration meditation first, which is known as calm abiding, which is described in the text in terms of eight stages of cultivation. So like I mentioned, you know, many Westerners, people like you and me, are doing this retreat, doing this getting concentration. So our friend Venerable Renee, years and years, I mean, he's done other meditations as well, but initially he was trying to get concentration. This is the first level we have to really get, you know, to really get some realizations. You can't dig very deep into the minds and unpack and unravel all the nonsense if you haven't got super clear focus. And you can't have super clear focus if you haven't got renunciation. Forget it. Not possible. So the fifth of the six perfections, the first of these two, this is the wisdom wings, what you do in your meditation. So you've got to perfect the concentration. And then the real work starts. But, I mean, then you start to get insight into emptiness using all the different logical arguments where you do your analysis, you do your deep kind of clear thinking that triggers the insight into how things have no intrinsic nature, which is what cuts the root of all the nonsense. Then you perfect all this, perfect this over life after life. But the point is... you can use these two modes of meditation to internalize karma. Every single thing you want to think about, if you choose to be a Buddhist and take on board, you buy into Buddha's views about the world. Like when Robbie studies music, he's buying into Bach's theories about music. He's not making up his own. Well, you know, if we decide to be a Buddhist, we're buying into Buddha's views, taking them as our hypothesis so that eventually we can see if they are true ourselves. But familiarizing our mind with karma, with impermanence, with compassion, with goodness. That's a really hard, full-on job to do every day by thinking and analyzing it. You don't just bliss out in meditation and do it. That's mystical and ridiculous. So, but here we're discussing realizing emptiness. So Mahamudra is this particular technique that actually is a sutra practice, but is always taught and given as a teaching in the framework of Tantra. So, you know, Lama Yeshe taught this for the first time in Australia, where he gave for the first time at the highest yoga tantra initiation in 1981, I think. Yeah, 81, I think. I'll just get the book. I'm going to read you from it. This came out last year, and I highly recommend you get it. It's wonderful. Mahamudra, How to Discover Our True Nature. It's called. I don't know where it is, though.
1981.
Thank you. Great, there you go. But I'm trying to find the book. I can't find the book. What do I do with it? I don't know. It's not here. I don't know where it is. What's that? I don't know where it is. Let me look for it.
Roman numeral 7?
What, darling? No, I'm looking for the book. I can't even find the book. Not the page. I don't know where it is. Never mind. I've got an old manuscript. I've got an old version here. Oh, here it is. What's this? There's something. I don't know what that is. There's something. Maybe it's an old version of it. Anyway, so what this is, yeah, Lama taught in 1981 in Australia, and he gave the Haruka Chakra Samvara initiation beforehand. It's always traditionally taught in the framework of having given a tantric initiation. And then at the end, you know, Lama taught very briefly on tantric Mahamudra, which is mostly the best technique is called, Tummo, inner heat. Lama wrote a book about that. So anyway, the point is, what it is this. On the face of it, it seems like a very simple technique. There's no complication. There's no drama. It's specifically a meditation technique. So the classical way you would use the two modes of meditation to get insight into the ultimate reality of things is you would first listen to the teachings very extensively, naturally. You know, like I said, Robbie can't just rush off. So the example of music is a good one. So the Mahamudra, okay, it's a more advanced technique, actually. On the face of it, it seems simple. But you compare my point now. The classical way of learning music, we know perfectly well, is Robbie would sit there and he'd study, I don't know whether he did, but never mind, it looks like he did, study the theories of music, and you squeeze your brain, isn't it? Learning all this Bach, complicated classical music theories. It's so complex. And then all these different things you have to learn, your scales and your arpeggios, unbelievable training your body and your mind in these things so that you can sit at the piano and actually practice it. So that's the way we learn everything. You learn the recipe of a cake first, then you make the cake. You learn the musical, you learn the theories of counting, and then you practice math. So that's the classic way we learn everything. You start with the theories and then you experientially do it. Well, this is exactly the same here. The classic way of becoming a Buddhist, you listen to the teaching, listen to impermanence, karma, all these different theoretical views, these views from the Buddha about reality, about how the world exists, and he's saying this is how things are. That's his view. Don't believe him. But he says this is the way things are, and our problem is we've got another set of views in our mind that he would say aren't how things are, and that's why we suffer. So you choose to internalize Buddha's views, and then gradually this seeps into you if you do it seriously, and then slowly in your life you experientially apply that. That's how we learn everything. So, you know, for example, if you have the view, so let's say you learn Buddha's view about karma. You've never heard of it before, that your consciousness is not physical. You've never heard the idea that your mother and father didn't make you, they gave you a body. And you've never heard the idea that your mind comes from before. And you've never heard the idea that everything you think and do and say stays in your mind and you get born in the life that you created from the past. I mean, what a brand new idea. So if we look at that now as a theory, learning, it's how would you apply that, and what is the experiential result for you? Well, as I've been talking all the time, the experiential result is, instead of thinking it's not fair, I didn't ask to get born, instead of blaming your mother and your father for making you, instead of blaming your boyfriend for your suffering, when you have this view of past consciousness and you have this view of karma, then you learn to internalize that, and guess what? The experiential result is you become less neurotic, less blaming, less miserable, less attached, and less angry. That's how you put your money where your mouth is. That's how you experience those theories. They have to stay in your head. That's how we learn everything. So with emptiness, it's exactly the same. We learn, like we've been talking about dependent arising as the king of logics to prove emptiness. We've been giving some of the discussions that we learn that Buddha says we have to meditate on, think about first, listen to first, and then meditate on, because that theory is what you then internalize in meditation, which then is what helps you counteract the lie that's in the mind. And that's when you realize the reality that there was no intrinsic I, never has been and never could be. And that is the radical shift that will happen in your mind so that you become a happy person. So there are two ways of doing meditating on emptiness. You listen to the classical way. You listen to the theories. Then you think about it and debate it. And then you internalize it in meditation till one day the penny drops. That's the typical way. Now, Mahamudra, so that's like Robbie learning music. You learn the theories, he goes to the piano, and he practices. But this other way, you listen to, this is actually quite advanced. But this is what Mahamudra is. Imagine, so this is the opposite for Robbie. So if it were music we were trying to do, like the Mahamudra style, you would go straight to the piano and you intuit Bach. Now that's interesting. That's difficult, isn't it? Most of us couldn't do that. But that's really what Mahamudra is. It's really quite radical. It's cutting right past the theories, right past all the dogma, right past the so-called dogma, all the theories and the philosophy. And you're learning to concentrate on the mind itself. And then you're beginning to observe the mind and attempt to catch the way ego is. I mean, it seems abstract for us, that concept, because we don't understand it, and I'll talk about it. But it's much more intuitive. It's much more less intellectual. But the irony is, you know perfectly well, for you to go to that piano and intuit Bach, it sort of implies you're already so intelligent. It sort of implies you've already got the music inside you. So it's a bitch catch 22, really. I mean, if you don't know anything about your mind, you're neurotic and deluded and angry and attached and jealous and angry, and you heard about sitting down, closing your eyes, and you realize emptiness, excuse me, you'll go straight to the psychiatric hospital. You'll be out of your brain. You haven't got a clue what you're doing. You don't know what the hell you're doing. And that's why so often when people misunderstand meditation and think you're just going to close your eyes and something mystical will happen, people go nuts because they have no idea about their mind. We don't learn about the mind in our culture. I'm sorry, we don't. So to sit there and imagine you're going to meditate, you lose your brain. I mean, many people too, this is what happens also. Sometimes when you meditate, no, forget that one, okay, forget that. Okay, so Mahamudra is the two modes of meditation. And this is how they work. So the first kind of mode of meditation, in the ordinary approach, the sutra approach of realizing emptiness, You would get your concentration, you'd do your single point of concentration technique, you'd use your breath, you'd use whatever you like to get it. So to the degree that you have any concentration, you then go to the second mode, and you've just been to your class that day, and you've heard about dependent arising, and you've written all your notes down, and now you'll go to the second mode of meditation after you've done your concentration, and then what you will do with that focused, laser-like focused mind, to the degree that you've got it, you will then take the information, like your 1 + 1 = 2, you'll take your theories, and you will think them through at a more subtle level. You'll think it through. You'll try to prove the logic of dependent arising. You know, you'll think through what you've learned. Well, if this is that and that is this and because of this and therefore this, and what did he say there? And then he said this and then he said that. That's how we learn everything. That's how you, when you study your music, that's how you learn your music. That's how you learn your math. That's how you learn anything. Learn a language like that. You listen to the information and you think about it properly. Then it becomes experiential. That's the classical way to do meditation on emptiness. So the stronger your focus, the more information you've studied and heard, the more you think about it, the deeper the insight will be until eventually you've got the direct realization of emptiness, you know. So Mahamud's different. The first mode is concentration, same. But the point here is, this is a specialty of Mahamudra. The thing you meditate on, the thing you focus on, the thing that you use to develop concentration isn't the breath, isn't a visualization, it's the actual mind itself. We did 5 minutes before we finished yesterday. So it's very puzzling to us. You sit down and you close your eyes and you try to watch what's going on in your mind. It's very peculiar, isn't it? You suddenly think, well, there's nothing going on in my mind. What's happening? You can't find any thoughts. Whereas normally they're racing like maniacs, you know? So the point is to learn, you have to practice that. So why is this? Lama talks about so much in the book how why this is so special, because the mind is so powerful, because mind, consciousness, this non-physical capacity for cognition, when we've got to harness it, it's super powerful. I mean, if I can just find where Lama talks about that. He said, even just watching your mind, even just focusing on the clarity of your mind can bring a very powerful taste. Not the same as Mahamudra, not the same as emptiness. Emptiness means Mahamudra. But it can give you a powerful taste because the mind is so spacious. And when you know what you're doing, you won't lose the plot. If you don't know what you're doing, you can get lost completely and completely stupid. You've got to have the proper instructions and have good teachers and know exactly what you're doing. And then even just get ordinary concentration. Remember, as Renee said, he needed years already of living in vows and lots of practice and lots of purification and lots of study and even giving lots of teachings. That was the preparation. You can't just, you know, you cannot, and in a way, that's the irony. You can't just go to the piano and start playing Bach. I'm sorry, it's super advanced. So it implies already you have done some work. And when you have done that work, you put the theory aside, and because you've got the theories inside your mind, you go to the piano, and you, if you really tune in, you'll be able to get that extraordinary music there. So it's actually quite an advanced practice. It sounds simple initially, but it's not, you know. But it's very powerful. I mean, Lama talks about here, I'll tell you that he talks about, I'll just read you from Lama. We talked about the mind. I'll talk about the mind, the way Lama talks about it. It's very nice. And then I'll talk about some of the qualities you'd accomplish having single point of concentration. Okay. So he says, this is chapter 7. Now, meditate on your mind. He says, maybe you're not sure what it means to meditate on your mind. Actually, it's simple. The Mahamudra way is to start by contemplating your concepts, the views of your own thoughts, your thoughts. And so what that means is this. Right now, this is very important to understand. We can see this. What happens now is, if we're busy with the cooking and the dinner and helping other people, that's what we're focusing on mostly. That's what we're doing, and that's great. So the thoughts are receding, aren't they? We're not noticing our mind. But we know when you're on your own, or you're trying to go to sleep, or you've got big worries, your mind, everything in the mind looms large. And all you can think about, all you can notice is all your crazy thoughts. Or, see, either the thoughts are just racing up and you don't know where they're coming from and we can't control them. Like when you're trying to go to sleep, it's like that, isn't it? You're not sitting there consciously thinking about anything, but the thoughts just come raging like maniac, like a big storm overwhelming you. And we're completely absorbed in it, aren't we? We've got no awareness, no clarity, and we can't stop it. But on the other hand, if you're really angry or upset with somebody, then you're consciously thinking all this story, and you can't stop the engaging in the thoughts. And you're full of rage and hurt and how dare he this and she that. And we're going nuts, you know. So this is the two ways that usually our mind dominates us. And we're conscious in neither of them. We don't have control in either of them. We can see that. So the point about Mahamudra is this. We have this big misconception about any meditation. You know, people say, oh, I tried to meditate yesterday and it didn't work. I mean, we have this bizarre assumption that as soon as you start to do concentration meditation, you're supposed to stop thinking. I mean, excuse me, that takes years and years of practice to access a subtle level of your mind, for goodness sake. That's like thinking you've got to start playing tennis today. Oh, I tried it, but I couldn't do it like Federer did. Well, of course not. We have these weird misconceptions, these weird expectations. I mean, it's really hard work to focus your mind, you know, because it's a big mess in there and we haven't ever paid attention to it before. So the thing about concentration meditation then, whether it's the mind you're watching or whether it's the breath, we've got to talk about this more. So exactly, this is the point. First of all, remember there are many parts of your mind. Like we talked, you've got your neurotic, unhappy anger and the attachment and the anxiety all kind of ebbing and flowing in there. Then you've got your virtuous qualities, which they're there, but often we don't notice them. They're kind of silent. For some reason, our big unhappy thoughts seem to loom large, don't they? Like I joke and I say, and that's really true, I've never met yet a person who says, oh, Rabina, I can't stop thinking good thoughts. No one ever says that. But we have to conjure them. We have to make them come. That's our problem. So anyway, the point is this. The thoughts are all chatting away, aren't they? We've got the negative ones, the positive ones, and then we've got these mechanics. They're not like thoughts, the way we think of thoughts, like stories. They're not like that. They're like I said, a mechanical part, a function. They're working all the time. We would never pay it. We don't notice them. It's like if you're driving a car, you're not noticing what the gear, the shift inside the engine is doing. You're not noticing what the carburetor is doing. I mean, these new engines have different things. They're all just working away. That's the mechanics of our mind. So there's many of these. Some of them are there every single second. So there's five of them that are there every second of your experience. And if any one of those five are missing, you'd be an insane person. Like a car wouldn't work if something didn't happen. And they're in the background. You don't notice them. But as we progress as meditators, we need to develop and become conscious of these parts of our mind because they're the mind. They're the ones that give us the ability to do things. So the major ones in meditation are this. So for example, the one that's always there, there's one that's called intention. This is profound, actually. This is the real meaning of the word karma. The word karma, Sanskrit, it means action, but the real action is mental action. In other words, everything starts with the thought. That's a big surprise to us because we just do everything automatically because we programmed our mind, you know? But the point is, intention, as Lama Zopa says, is a saying in Tibetan, everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought. And that's there every millisecond. Every millisecond is an intention. Every millisecond is an intention. And that's what drives everything we think and do and say. But of course we don't notice because we're on autopilot. We just don't notice. The next one is attention. That your home, when you think of something, intention, you know, I'll go for the cake. That attention then focuses in on the cake and you pay attention to that. And then all the other bits of your mind make you stand up and walk in the right direction to get the cake. So attention is the next one. And that's really the one that does the looking. So we're thinking of meditating. You're going to watch your, instead of just think of watching your breath, forget your mind for the moment, forget Mahamudra for the moment. Your breath is the object. You've made a decision. You're going to concentrate on the breath, which means you're going to pay attention. Pay attention. You're going to pay attention to the breath. That's what he does, the looking, is attention. It's one particular part. But it's got to be supported by several others. One of them, the crucial one, this is what we hear a lot about, it's actually called mindfulness. We've got such mistaken conception of it. Mindfulness is really better called short-term memory. Mindfulness actually, it's got this whole meaning in the West, all these bells and whistles, it's almost like its own religion now. It's really such a mistake. The actual meaning of this mechanical part of your mind is the ability to not forget what you're doing second by second. That's mindfulness. And that's what we're trying to train. That's the major one. So the part that helps your attention stay on the breath is it's supported by mindfulness. That makes it stay. But there's another part that's even watching above that. And His Holiness calls that like the policeman. And that's called vigilance. or alertness. And that's another part. We don't notice these parts. They're like the bits of the engine. We don't notice. But then we've got to train. That's what we're doing in meditation. We are actively training these parts of our mind. We're not training love. We're not training generosity. We're not even training wisdom. We're trying to train the mechanical parts of our mind to do their job properly and be really sophisticated at their job. We need super clear intention, super clear attention, super clear mindfulness, super clear alertness. These are, so really meditation is described in the text. You know, the job is to stay one-pointedly on one thing. Now that we just do not do that because our mind is all over the place. And the two main obstacles to our ability to do that. One is the capacity of the mind, and this is how we're spending all our lives, is just to be out of control, excited. And that's attachment energy. Never stopping thinking, never stopping worrying, anxious, this, that, do this, maybe that. Off, your mind rushes off. They call it excitement. It's this ability, it's this function of the mind to never stop chatting, never stop chatting, never stop chatting. So the other extreme, the other obstacle to getting concentration is the other extreme of the mind, which is to space out. To forget what you're doing. I mean, we go between these two extremes, and the whole of the nine stages of single point of concentration, as it's taught in the sutras, you know, is this continuous bringing the mind away from the excitement and away from the dullness, as they call it, to finally get this in between this almost invisible place now that we do not have. Once you've perfected mindfulness and perfected alertness, and everything is, and you've got concentration, where now the mind is neither berserk nor spaced out. And it's this kind of invisible place of super sharp, super light as a feather, blissful, sharp focus. Even I said, even Andre, even Venerable Renee said, even to the fifth of the nine stages after his 2.5 years. There's no, I mean, there already is incredible level of concentration. And he said, and this is the indication of the subtlety of it, the joy that his mind naturally experienced. Because at that level already, you're really subdued to a profound degree the constant berserk chatting and the sensory consciousness. This is the fifth of the nine. Very, very inspiring, you know. So it's enormous hard work. Enormous hard work. And to do it all day, every day for several years. Oh my God, can you imagine? It'd be pretty renounced to do that. Pretty disciplined. Pretty amazing. So all these bits of your mind are the bits doing the job. Now, this is one of the interesting points. We're very obsessed with the idea that I am watching my mind. Yeah. I am watching my breath. Well, you are. You can't say it's not true. But let's say I am holding an iPad. I am. But let's be precise, please. Let's be precise. My right hand is holding an iPad. That's also precise. Let's be more precise. The finger's doing this. The pinky is doing that. The ring finger is doing this. Each piece of my hand has its job. And this is what we try to do with meditation. And we become very sophisticated in our ability to know those parts of our mind and to train each one so that all together the mind is now focused, you know. So it's a super difficult job. We have to know the mind well, though. So, okay. What happens, so okay, meditation, concentration meditation is not a technique to make the thoughts go away. It is not a relaxation technique. It is not to have some kind of vision or experience. None of this is the issue. None of this is the point, you know. What you're doing, it's training your mind to concentrate. That's it. When you learn to ride a bike, the job is to stay on the bike. The job isn't to have a nice experience. The job isn't to suddenly ride like Federer overnight. The job isn't to look at the sky, look at all the scenery. No, the job is to simply learn to train yourself to stay on the bike. So the first time you get on the bike on the left side, you'll fall off on the right side. Well, imagine if you forgot what you were doing, which is what happens. You space out. You start looking at the sky. I think he's in the sky. Lovely. It is lovely. But it's not the point. You got to get back on the bike again. And you keep focusing on the bike. It doesn't matter what the weather is. It doesn't matter how nice the scenery is. It doesn't matter if you feel good or bad. You're training your body to stay on the bike. Well, that's what you're doing in concentration. It's really hard work. It demands discipline, rigor. It's not blissful. It's not delicious feelings. None of that's the issue. We're so obsessed with feelings in our culture. It's like embarrassing. It's like childlike, you know, childish. We're obsessed with feelings. It's like unbelievable. It's sort of like thinking that playing the piano is going to sit on the piano and suddenly you say some, you play some blissful music. Oh, I had an amazing time on the piano today. Oh, please play it again. Oh, no, I can't do that. We think of it as experiences. It's not experiences. It's training. You're training. You're training. That's what it is. You're training to get concentration. It's a really hard work. You enjoy the process. You might feel bad one day. You might feel good the next. But you're training. That's it. You're familiarizing your mind with concentration. So calm down about it, you know. You might feel good. It's a bonus. It's not the point, though. You might calm your mind down. That's great. It's not the point, though. You will eventually. But you're training, rigorously training your mind to bring the mind away from excitement and bring the mind away from dullness. It's constant, you know, real sophisticated hard work to know exactly how to see it and what to do. So the problem is for all of us, we just start to meditate, you know, we're not familiar with our minds. We see all this, we think we're getting worse, but this is a really good sign, you know. In the texts, the traditional texts, they say one of the signs of success at the first of the 9 stages of cultivating single point of concentration is that you think your mind's getting worse. You think your mind's more berserk. It's not more berserk. It's just you've never paid attention to it before. It's like you go to the gym for the first time. You discovered muscles you didn't know you had. But you know it's a good sign. It demands enormous discipline. Because the mind wants to be lazy. It wants to sink into its own thoughts. It wants to sort of relax. And we just, that's the inertia of attachment, you know. So the thing is, the trouble is, so okay, with Mahamudra, what you're focusing on, instead of the breath, you're deciding to focus on whatever pops up in the mind, which is really hard because you kind of can't find it. The breath is easy to find, you know. It's easy. You can kind of locate it. You space out, but you come back to the breath again because there it is right there, a physical thing. But the mind is kind of too spacey and weird. I mean, when all the thoughts are running crazy. So what you're trying to do is this, and this is the point. You're not trying to make the thoughts go away. This is the point. You're not trying to make the thoughts go away. That's a foolish thing to do. You can't do that. You're not trying to wish the thoughts weren't there. You're not trying to criticize the thoughts. You try to do none of that. So, you know, you could do, and the aim of this meditation, the point of this meditation isn't, oh, I had a good meditation, my mind calmed down. No, the short-term goal, is you want to observe your mind because it is a short-term. Because in your daily life, you want to know what the hell is going on in your mind. You want to know what's going on in your mind. So you have to be able to see it. Not just run away from it, not to wish it wasn't there. So of course with Mahamudra, eventually, with this practice, the mind will calm down when you get good concentration. But it's not a question of, I wish it would calm down. I mean, you need to know what's in your mind. It's like if you're learning to be an oncologist, you want to see all the disgusting cancer. And as soon as the patient comes in, you don't want to show you're excited to look at their cancers, but you are. Because this is your expertise. You don't start getting excited about the person's cancer. They'll get upset. But you want to see all the cancers. You want to see exactly what this one, what that one. You don't want to wish that it'll go away. Why do you want to see the cancer? Because you know where the problem is and now you know how to heal it. That's the attitude we have to have to our mind. It's a very different attitude because we feel so guilty and angry. We wish it would all go away. And that's one of the main problems with meditation in the West. We think it's an alternative to a pill. In other words, we only will do it when you're going berserk. Instead of going to a therapist, you've heard this will work. I mean, that's just demented. That's completely demented. You don't wait till your wheels are falling off to go to the mechanic. You don't wait till your teeth are falling out to go to the dentist. We wait till we're going crazy before we go to a therapist or before we look at our own mind. But that's the thing. We want to see the mind as soon as we can. And we want to identify the anger. We want to see the attachment, the jealousy, the anxiety. And at the moment, it's a big soup. We can't tell one bit from another. But that's the clarity we must develop. We need to see our mind intimately and precisely. So with Mahamudra, you're not focusing on all that. You're not doing any analysis. But inevitably, your mind's, so you start, it's like trying to think of it as you're going to watch television, but no commentary. You let all the crazy things happen. You just watch and you focus on whatever is there. No commentary. You don't try to conjure any thoughts. You don't have a discussion with the thoughts. You don't have an opinion about the thoughts. You don't wish they weren't there. You don't wish they were there. You just learn to have this attention. Simply pay attention. That's the job. So in a sense, it's easy, but we're so used to becoming absorbed in our thoughts and having them and hating them and loving them and wishing they're blah, blah, being a player. We've got to keep distant. We've got to keep ourselves let the thoughts come because that's our habit. Thoughts are just there because they're old habits shouting away in our head, aren't they? So we learn to observe. And the point is, the aim of the Mahamudra meditation long term is for your mind to calm down eventually. Of course it is. And this is the point. The more we buy into each of the thoughts and have a conversation, that's what keeps that's like stirring the water. It'll keep being turbulent. But if you allow the thoughts to be there without commentary, without analysis, without aversion, without attachment, you just observe the thoughts. And we should do this throughout the day. This is being a Buddhist, you know. Without fear or panic, then in the meditation, if you're training to be meditative, and you're doing the same, you need your attention, you need your concentration, you need your mindfulness, you need your alertness, all the same pieces. You have to adjust your mind when it gets berserk and all those things, just the same as if you're watching your breath. But the object is the thoughts themselves. And as you get better at this, the actual object becomes called the clarity of your mind. The clarity of your mind, which is kind of like it's a hard one to understand. This doesn't mean like clear thinking. It means more not physicality of it. And there's something very profound about the mind when we can get beyond the conceptual berserkness and beyond the sensory. There's something very subtle and very profound about our capacity for cognition, this non-physical cognition. And it gives us a very powerful taste, Lama saying, of non-duality, you know. So your first part of meditation is your concentration. Your first part of meditation is the concentration. So when you get some semblance of focus, as Lama says, you then decide to go to the second mode of meditation, which is where what you're learning to do is you stay focused on the mind. You stay focused. You don't ever waver from that. But as Panchen Lama says, the 17th century Lama, whose text this is, that Lama Yeshe gave a commentary on, this, you conjure this subtle wisdom. It's like watching something out of the corner of your eye. Like they use the analogy, you're driving on the freeway, aren't you? You'll never lose your focus on one. It's a really good example. You know, if you're a really good driver, you never lose your focus. For 1 second, you couldn't, you'd crash. You've got your focus continuously on that lane. But out of the corner of your eye, you're seeing all these other things happening. You have to, don't you? But you never lose your focus. And if you do this when you freak out, isn't it? Never crash. You keep absolutely focused. You never waver from that. But you're aware out of the corner of your eye of all the other things happening. So clearly it's more subtle here. You stay on the mind, but you then actively activate, as Panchen Lama says, a subtle wisdom. As Lama Yeshe so sweetly calls it, your mindfulness fish. Because Panchen Lama uses an analogy in his text. He said this subtle wisdom, the subtle part of your mind is going to kind of go out. He said it's like a small fish in a pond of water that moves through the water without disturbing it. So Lama calls it your mindfulness fish. So this subtle part of your mind is going to now observe, like from a distance, observe to catch how you experience your ego. That's the job. That's the job of Mahamudra meditation. I'm going to just read from Lama a bit. Just give a taste about the meditating on the mind. So now maybe you're not sure what it means, meditate on your mind, you know. Actually, it's simple. The Mahamudra way is to start by concentrating your concepts, the views of your own thoughts. Your thoughts are viewpoints, aren't they? So you've got to watch them. Just watch them. That's it. No comment. Eventually, this leads to, of course, if you're a good meditator, eventually this leads to an experience, to experience the clarity of your consciousness, which is that's known as this conventional nature. So we observe the thoughts. And then we let go. No intellect. We don't analyze our thoughts. Leaving the mind as it is like this is the special emphasis of this meditation. You just let whatever arises, arise. This is a powerful practice. And day to day, I mean, listen to this in your daily life, you know. If we could do this, we wouldn't go berserk. But what do? As soon as the sound, we run to it like a magnet and criticize it or like it. As soon as there's anything on the freeway, we have no control over our mind. We feel compelled to run our lives by having opinions all day about everything. We leak in and stick our nose every day. We read the papers, we go crazy. We see the next door neighbor, we go crazy. We see our kid, we go crazy. We never stop sticking our nose in having opinions. We assume it's our job to have opinions about the whole universe. Why do you think we all go crazy? I mean, it seems inconceivable to us to observe a sound. Let the sound be there. None of your damn business. Keep yourself relaxed and let the sound be there. This is so profound, it's like a joke, but it's so simple. We don't know how to do it because we're attacked with an aversion. We run like all over the place, jumping here, jumping there. We can't let anything happen without us jumping in and having an opinion. That's why we all go crazy. It's attachment and anger, people. Look at the world. Why do you think we're exhausted by the end of the day? Don't you dare blame the sound for your misery. It's your attachment jumping into the sound and getting angry with it. I mean, so we don't notice the sound mind, you know? It's incredible, this. It's profound. Just to let things be. This is a powerful practice. You don't live your life the whole time like that. Clearly you've got to make some decisions at some point. Oh, there's a car coming at me. I'll just let it be. No, don't be stupid. Get out of the way. It's an amazing practice. Not just to let attachment and aversion leap into everything, you know, all the time. We've got to mind our, let a sound be there. It's a really good practice. If a sound comes, let it be there. You don't have to have an opinion about it. It's a really profound level of practice, the first level. And that's the beginning of the Mahamudra one. Just let your mind be there. And the fact is, of course, we haven't got much concentration. You can't help but notice out of the corner of your eye your anger, your attachment, your anxiety, and you need to see them. You won't work on them then, but you remember them, and you see them in your daily life, and that's when you're working in the kitchen, you're working on the driving, you're talking to your friends, you're doing exactly the same thing. You're watching your thoughts. That's the skill of being a Buddhist every day. That is the skill of being a Buddhist every day. You're not just absorbed in the traffic. You're not just absorbed in your husband. Your mind going crazy having an opinion and you don't even notice, but you're noticing your thoughts and you're controlling. This is so grown up, I tell you. That's the job of being a Buddhist, and that's what Mahamudra is. So Mahamudra meditation emphasizes not analyzing, you know? Because when the mind is analyzing, it's trembling, it's shaking, isn't it? It's like an airplane. It's turning, it shakes. That's what our mind's doing all the time, is constantly having opinions, never stopping. Like as if it's our, you know, we must have an opinion about everything. You think about the world. We think we have a right to have constant opinions about every single person, every single thing. Eventually, when we've got wisdom, you must have opinions, but it's going to be based on intelligence and compassion. Then you can help them. But people trying to calm the craziness of our attachment and aversion and all the crazy stories in there, we just jump into everything. And then why don't we all go crazy, you know? Lamasong Kapa says that when we contemplate the consciousness, the mind, your thoughts, we should not follow any object. So we refer to this approach, it's simply as non-conceptual, non-superstitious. In Tibetan, they call it maintaining a non-conceptual state of mind. It's a really good practice in daily life. Working on the dishes, you know, it's incredible. Everything. Being conscious of your thoughts. But don't give opinions yet. Just watch. Just watch. You have to work with them. You have to know what they are. And you don't work on them then. You concentrate. In the dishes, yeah. But focusing on the mind, you don't have opinions. You leave them there. As I mentioned, Lama Tsongkhapa is using our own mind as the object of concentration in Mahamudra meditation is a very sensitive, direct method. It easily eliminates all the craziness and this confusion. This is the point, and therefore easily leads to the realization of emptiness. Really easily leads us to enable us to see more clearly what's happening. In other words, long term, you get the clarity of your mind, and then this mindfulness fish comes up and watches like a hawk, watching for the way ego rises. Watching for the way we clean, because it's happening all the time. This is a subtle delusion. The subtle ego grasping is there all the time. So we have to calm down the grosser level so we can begin to notice it. It's the subtlest one. So the two main obstacles in meditation. So countless obstacles prevent us from obtaining perfect concentration, but we can include them in two categories. As I've said, one is that the mind constantly distracted, excited, all over the place, unable to focus. And the other one is like dull. The mind becomes very dull and spaced out and sluggish. Now, one of the big problems with that is when people meditate, many people can sit down and be very relaxed. And that's wonderful. This is, again, like I'm saying, this is not a relaxation technique. It is wonderful to relax. It is wonderful to do those yoga practices and space out. It's just fantastic. We need it desperately. But this is not that. You need to be alert and sharp because you're trying to train your mind to stay sharp and focused. One of the characteristics of a sharp, focused mind is crystal clarity, not any sense of spacing out, not any sense of dullness. It's effortlessly crystal clear as well as eventually as being super relaxed, but crystal clear. If you lose that crystal clarity, you've lost the plot, you know? So it's not a relaxation technique. There are wonderful ones, but don't confuse, you know? So all the way through these nine stages of concentration meditation, they're all discussing the levels of, you know, of the two extremes of excitement or dullness. And as you're progressing in concentration, you're lessening each of those extremes until eventually you've completely conquered the excitedness and you've completely conquered the alertness and you've completely perfected mindfulness and you've completely perfected alertness until eventually you have this subtle state of concentration, you know? Which is, as I said, we can hear these words, but when you hear what you'd be like if you had it, it'll blow your mind. And I'll read to you. Because we can only hear the words according to what we can think, you know? There's no need to clear the mind, clean the mind. You know, we think, oh, my mind's so busy, how can I meditate? Well, it's fine, a great way to meditate. It's like being in the middle of the traffic. It's a perfect time to meditate. It's a perfect time not to stick your nose in and wish it wasn't there. Just focus on the noise. It's a whole great exercise. Just focus on the noise. That's it. Nothing wrong with that. Let it be there. Mind your own business. If you kick your mind in yourself, that's what we mean by being centered. We use that term centered. It's very nice. If you're in the traffic and you're a good driver, as we call it, stay centered. What it means is don't get distracted. Don't have aversion for the loud noises. Don't get annoyed with the next door car. Don't want it to do what you want it to do. Focus on yourself. Focus on the driving and you'll stay relaxed. We don't believe that, but this is the truth, you know, because we're in control of our own mind. Relaxation doesn't come from being quiet in the trees. You can be living in the night. I mean, I don't forget one time when I had this, when I was in the middle of the most pristine bush in Australia, up in the middle of Alice Springs in the Red Desert. It was like sublime. The sky was amazing. And I remember I was with this, my beloved at the time, and we were having a fight. It was the worst night, it was the worst mental suffering of my life. I remember one time when I lived in New York City, my mind was the most peaceful it had ever been. So it just shows the external isn't always the main thing. I remember my little apartment in New York down the village. I had a little tree outside, the birds were singing, and it was delicious, but it was still in the middle of Manhattan. My mind was peaceful. Living in the middle of the ideal bush, my mind was like living in hell. So it shows the mind is the main thing. It really proves it, doesn't it? So don't, no need to clean the mind, as Lama said. So you just watch your thoughts. That's it, so simple. Maybe not literally watch. Language is a problem, but be like the sunlight, which merely shines, you know, use these analogies. Normally we think our mind is bad, deluded, and we have to make it clean. No. Mind's nature, you know, mind's nature is clean, clear. Clarity is a fundamental characteristic of all our states of mind. This applies both, you know, so you don't need to make an effort to make your mind this way or that. You just need to leave it alone. Its clear light nature is pure from the beginning. You know, so even your anger, think about that. It's just thoughts. So water is naturally clear. And when it's still, it's clear and still. But the waves are still water, aren't they? They're the same nature as the water. So anger and attachment are like these waves on our mind. So if you can learn just to observe them, but not being involved in them, you know, it's very powerful practice, very powerful practice. But you don't always have to do that because also at some point you've got to work on the anger. That's a different practice. But this is within the meditation where you're trying to just observe, you know, not get involved. Just observe. But when you come out of your meditation, you don't just observe your anger as you're killing your husband. Kindly stop your anger, okay? No expectations. Abandon expectations. Any hope. You know, grasping at some kind of experience. I'll never forget one fellow who did some kind of meditation, doesn't matter what kind. He'd been doing it for 25 years and he was almost in tears. He said, I've been waiting for 25 years for an experience and it won't come. He was nearly going mad. This is like the worst detachment. I mean, that's like demented to think that's the purpose of your meditation. That's the biggest problem. And that's why we always think we're failing because we're never meeting our own expectations. Oh, I should have meditated by now. Or I should have realizations by now. We're always being dissatisfied with what we've achieved. This is a terrible, it's like a crime against ourselves, you know. So don't have any, just do the job. Do the job of just getting on the bike and trying to stay on it. then get off and you fall off, get back on again. That's it. Not all the dramas we go around, you know? So neither, see, one of the biggest problems with meditation, one of the ideas is that you might get special feelings. And the fact is, because the mind is so amazing, it is often true. And then people who've never meditated before, but you could argue they've had meditation experiences in a past life, they suddenly sit down and concentrate. I had so many stories like that. People get some bliss, they get some kind of vision, and then they don't understand attachment, and they don't understand anger, and they completely lose the plot, and they think they're like, you know, God incarnate, and they go crazy. I've met many people who've gone crazy because they suddenly think they're enlightened, because they have this blissful feeling. I mean, that's why you've got to know your mind well. You've got to study it and do lots of purification and lots of practice so you don't lose the plot. As Lama said, so many people go off to meditate and end up in the psychiatric hospital because they haven't got a clue what's going on. We have no knowledge of the mind or the unconscious in our culture with respect to us. I mean, we don't have any view of past karma bringing old stuff into our lives. We have no memory, no sense of that, you know. So you've really got to know what you're doing. And no expectations. So concentration, Lama says, you know, even if you have a vision of the Buddha, live on. It's not your job here. It's like you think your job is to ride the bike, but you forget and you fall off the bike and the sky is lovely and you start enjoying the sky. It's very nice to enjoy the sky, but that wasn't the job. The job is to ride the bike. So shut up and get back on the bike. Same here. The job isn't to have a vision. The job isn't to have an insight. The job is to get concentration. So you stay on the job, please, you know. Deal with your vision later. So Lama just gives these nice analogies, you know. Your consciousness is like the sun. Just like the sun's rays shoot out from the sun, your thoughts, your views, all the right ones, all the wrong ones, manifest from your consciousness. Whatever thought you experience, keep your mindfulness of it continuously. That is the meditation. Like space. Your mind is like space. When the rain comes, the space is not disturbed. Rain falls, but still it's part of space. When the rain is strong, it's disturbing, but when it stops, things become quiet and peaceful again. The rainfall is similar to all the delusions, all the rubbish. When they are manifesting, it's disturbing, but they still have non-duality nature, those thoughts, you know. Like the ocean. Your mind is like the blue ocean. It's there. You just watch it. Your thoughts are like the waves. Waves manifest from the ocean, but they are still part of the ocean. When a wave rises out of the ocean, there's some turbulence. When it drops back into the ocean again, it's not different from the ocean, is it? Like the full moon. Your consciousness is like the full moon. On this earth, all the people and fishes and chickens and trees, all the organic things are moving, functioning. But the full moon is just there. Your intensive awareness remains intensive awareness of consciousness, even though the distractions themselves are coming and going. They no longer energize you. They no longer distract you. You remain on the mind with intensive mindfulness. Learn to let go. So when you reach the point when you can experience the clarity of your consciousness, then you try to let go. Keep your concentration a little loose rather than exerting tremendous effort. Don't squeeze your mind. Too much effort, too strict discipline is not good. This is really clear, you know. I remember one time when you're driving, for example. I remember one time I was in Germany and I wasn't that familiar with driving on the right side of the road at that time. And I was driving from Munich to Berlin, a big conference in Berlin, with all our big truck. I was driving the truck with all our things for our exhibition from the center there. And driving back, I mean, they drive very fast in Germany, 180 kilometers an hour. That's 120 miles, 30 miles an hour in the fast lane. And there's no limit to speed limit there. The fast lane is like the aeroplanes, 180 to 200 kilometers an hour, I promise you. And it's the law. You're allowed to. It's unbelievable. It's scares the life out of you if you're not driving fast. And not like in America where you sit in the right lane, in the front, in the first lane, because they're driving 55 miles an hour, it's the law, and refuse to move. You'd get murdered in Germany. The guy behind you just toots his horn once and you whiz over to the slow lanes. No choice. It's very efficient. I tell you, they're wonderful. I love driving in Germany. Anyway, this particular time in this truck, can you imagine, that the road had been, there was some roadworks, so they had a middle lane with those yellow cones either side of the lane, and it was like 50, 60 kilometers, and the car, you can't go to any other lane. So all the cars are going like 150 kilometers an hour. I had no choice, and I will never forget as long as I live how much I had to focus. It was absolutely terrifying, I can't tell you. But what I'm meaning is, if you get too stressed, That's when you make mistakes, isn't it? So you got, even though I was whizzing along, I had to relax. I had to find a way to relax my mind. Otherwise I would have crashed into the cones and caused multiple, you know, accidents. It was so intense. I had to relax. There was no choice. I had to relax. So let go, as Lama says. And our trouble is, and this is where they say in meditation, and people who are seriously doing concentration techniques, it's so difficult to get this fine point, the fine balance between putting the appropriate amount of effort and then also relaxing, because we often put too much effort. And then, as you know, you've heard, if you're a Tibetan Buddhist, the Tibetan term for the wind energies, which is this component of our mind, the subtle body, is they call it lung. So one of the diseases you have is when extreme tension, when you're really having a panic attack. That's what they call lung, an imbalance of the wind. And that's the commonest thing for many meditators, because you're making such effort, you have to concentrate. But if you don't know how to do it properly, you can make yourself crazy, you know, you completely cause yourself to get sick. So it's a very fine balance to get. And don't reject distractions. This is the whole point. We have this deep assumption that I shouldn't have thoughts, or I shouldn't be having thoughts. I mean, that's bizarre. What do you mean you shouldn't have thoughts? You have got thoughts. So work with them, you know. Or I shouldn't be angry. Or I shouldn't be jealous. You go mad. So don't feel bad when distractions come. I mean, they're there most of the time. Don't get upset and reject them. There's no need to think, oh, this is ego, it's bad. Recognize these deluded thoughts. They're just the witness, like the, you know, the waves of the ocean. The dualistic thoughts, all the rubbish, are simply manifestations of the mind. They're just popping up like a wave, you know, relax. Look at the essential nature of the thoughts. They are also clear in their nature. When they come, instead of rejecting them, look, penetrate into their, and penetrate into their essential nature. Or think the thoughts are just like the birds, or the airplanes, or the organic things that move in the space of your consciousness. They come and they go. Just let go. You can use your awareness to watch the essence of these deluded thoughts. You know, this is, we understand this. We really understand this, you know. Is there any questions about that part so far? Just any questions about meditating on your mind? It's such a good practice to try and do, you know, just to sit there and just watch. That's it. Any questions about it?
There are a couple of questions, Venerable, but they're not relating to what you've just been.
Oh, okay. What are they?
Do you want me to go ahead?
Yes.
Okay. Brian asks how we can apply today's teachings to the craziness that we're seeing today in these scary times.
When did Brian ask that question? Before this discussion about Mahamudra?
Yes. Yes, well,
I think, Brian, I've just given you one answer, isn't it? I mean, there's various ways. You know, this is the first one, I think. It's a very powerful one. Because what happens is we see all the craziness, and because we have attachment's not getting what it wants, so we get stressed and angry, and then we're all over the place. So this is a really powerful practice in the quiet at home. When you just hear all the news, all the craziness, just observe it. Don't have to watch with your eyes closed and do meditation. Just think, observe it. So just observe it. Just observe it and don't leap into it and have opinions. This is a very powerful practice to steady you first. You've got to steady yourself first. Just observe it. Now, the more you understand karma, the more you understand attachment, the more you understand anger, the more you understand why it is happening. Because often that's what freaks us out. We go, why is this happening? Why is this happening? That's our agony. But if you're a Buddhist and you have a view of karma, that gives you the why, and that can help calm you down. But the practice is here just to observe it, not to be involved in it, in your mind. But then, of course, that's not meant to be sort of like you don't care. That's not the issue here. That's not the practice. I'm not trying to become indifferent. That's one particular practice to steady your mind. You've got to steady your mind. You can't do anything to help people if you don't steady your mind. If you're all over the place and getting angry and upset and depressed, you can't help a fly. So it's a powerful practice. This one, exactly what I'm saying. Let it be there. Then when you want to engage in it, you understand karma. You try to watch your mind. You try, you know, you understand what racism is. You understand what anger is. You understand what craziness is. And then you try not, and then you learn from it. And then you try and have compassion and do what you can. So there's different levels of practices at different times. But the fundamental one is we can't control our mind. If we can't stay steady, we can't do any of the other work. We can't do anything to help anybody. We're just, you know, we've got to learn to train our mind, understand our own mind deeply. Then we can be effective in helping others. And when bad things happen, you won't lose the plot. You'll know what to do, you know. So it's a fundamental starting point. What else, Donna? Sweetheart, what else?
So Elise actually asked a follow-up to Brian's question.
Yes, Elise. What was it?
It's a little bit long.
Elise Strabel, she asked, did you know it? Well, why don't you say it yourself? Do you want to say it, Elise, or you want Donna to read it?
Well, Venerable, I was wondering, just as you said, when we begin to meditate, we think we're getting worse because, we have all this bad stuff come up.
Elise, it's already been there. We're seeing it. It's already been there, but we're seeing it now. That's the difference. No, it doesn't come up. It's already there, but now we're noticing it. That's the difference, a big point.
Right. So you say, great, the dirt has to come out.
Well, that's something, let's talk about that. But, that's the one. I'll talk about that. That's the point you're making, is it?
Well, what I was wondering is, when we look at all the awful things that are happening here in the USA and around the world, is it appropriate to think of it kind of in that way as well?
I think it is, I think it is. I mean, that's always, I think, what happens. And let's just look at the first one about the dirt coming out. I'll use the story I always tell. And this is a major, major, major step in our practice. It's a major understanding to have. It's such an important point. I can't stress it. I can't tell you enough, The number of people who practicing for years and years and practicing, and then they say, oh, I'm so angry. I can't believe my anger's still there. My jealousy's still there. I seem to be getting more angry. I seem to be getting more jealous. And we're really freaked out because the assumption is if I'm practicing, I should be getting better. But the point is this, I don't think we know the depth of this stuff. This is a Buddhist point. It's so, so subtle and so deep. So the analogy I use, for example, first of them, is one going to the gym. When you're overweight and no muscle tone, and you go to the gym because you get all excited because you want to get thin and with muscle tone. So when you come home the first day, it's not a joke, it's true. You can't believe, you've got so much pain, you can't believe it. So if you were just sitting watching television and had that pain, you should be worried. But you know that pain coming home from the gym is a good sign. I mean, we know this so deeply and so well. You don't get freaked out. You know it's a sign that you're doing the work. So the muscles start to hurt. That's a really good sign. So this is exactly the point, Elise's point. One of our friends years ago, Australian monk, Roger, not Lama Zopa's attendant, another one, a meditator, 35 years off and on, doing 3-year retreats, 4-year retreats. He's in long-term meditation now in Rinpoche Center in Big Sur in California, 3-4-year retreat, long-term. He told me years ago that after many retreats, he thought he was going crazy with extra levels of anger and rage and arrogance. He was really out of control. He was freaking out, And he went to Lama Zopa, really distressed. And Rinpoche laughed and laughed and laughed and said, fantastic, the dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. This is what Elise said. And it's a profound point. Rinpoche wasn't just trying to make him feel better. This is the thing we have to understand, which means we have to have real courage, understanding what the mind is, and not just following this junky child attachment that just wants it to go all away. We can't bear the pain. So we've got to confront the pain. If you don't like pain, then you'll stop going to the gym the first day. So if you don't want you don't want to confront your delusions and confront the misery and see it and own it and understand it and look into it and taste it, then don't be a Buddhist. Because if you just think being a Buddhist is having a nice feeling and getting mindful, it's like pathetic to think that. It's really hard work. Like one of my therapist friends who's a Buddhist said, it's like having your hands in your own shit. And that's not a joke. It's true. So you've got to have courage to do it. And why does the dirt come out? Why? Because you're seeing the problem is the garbage in our mind. And Buddha says this is why we're suffering. And the long-term goal is to get rid of it. So you clearly have to see it. If you don't know you've got cancer, how can you solve it? You've got to see the disgusting cancer and then fix it. So we've got to be courageous to see our mind and know that if we are practicing, a sign of success, like when you put your clothes in the washing machine, you don't freak out when you see the dirty water. You're happy. The dirt is coming out. It's really profoundly true. And then we have great courage, And we have to see the problems. We have to know anger intimately. We have to know anxiety and stress and jealousy and fear. If you just think that we can all go away, it's like insane, completely insane. They won't just go away. You've got to unpack and deconstruct them and go through them and pass them. And then and that way they dissipate because you argue with them and go beyond them and understand them. And then they just disappear to spoke. That's a really important point, Elise. Very necessary because the junkie in us, the attachment wants to feel nice all the time. And we don't feel nice when we see our shitty mind, We have a fight with somebody, get all stressed. Or, and that's the problem, when we see the rest of the world, it's exactly the same. If we can't handle our own unhappiness, how in the name of heaven can we bear the suffering of the world, you know? This is really true, Elise. So when we have some semblance of control over our own mind and some compassion for ourselves and understanding it, we will be able to have compassion for others and we won't lose the plot. We can go out there and help as much as we can and we'll have a good sleep and we'll go back again the next day all full of enthusiasm. We want to help. But if we're overwhelmed by our own misery, we can't help a fly, really. So we have to know it's a good sign. It gives us courage and then we can help more and more. Do you understand, Elise?
Yes, so, thank you, Annabelle. Thank you for being here.
Oh, pleasure, darling. I wish I was there with you, having a cup of tea. Yes, next year. Go on, people. What else, Donna, darling?
Yes, Fernanda wants to ask a question.
Mm-hmm. Go, Fernanda. What time are we finishing? It's now, isn't it?
I'm sorry. I forgot to unmute myself.
Hang on. Just a sec, Fernanda. It's time to go, isn't it?
Yeah.
Donna, wait. Well, we can go on a bit, can't we? We're okay?
It's okay with me. I know you've got something at 4:30, but we have time here.
We're fine. We'll just see how it goes. It'll find its own natural end. Keep going. Fernanda, go, darlings.
Yes. Is Mahamudra then a way to be aware without attachment, and this will help us control our emotions?
It's not called that. It's a method for realizing emptiness. Specifically, it is a method for realizing emptiness. But it will have that benefit, obviously. That'll be one of the benefits of it. Of course it will be. It's not the purpose of it.
Okay.
Its purpose is to realize emptiness. But that will come naturally. You understand?
And then to not be attached, it will help you enough to have lung. To not have attachment towards it's coming to your mind, it will help you to not have a lung or anxiety attack or something.
Yeah, of course, darling, because anxiety is attachment energy gone berserk. You see, attachment is so multifaceted. It's not how we think of it normally. It's not just liking cakes, you know. It's profoundly deep and primordial in us. And it's one function is the dissatisfaction. From practicing attachment in past lives, we get born in this life deeply dissatisfied. We call it self-hate in our culture. It's our main disease, as Lama Zopa says. It's from practicing attachment. Because the attachment is this, and the next, so one of the heart, the core function of attachment is an over-exaggeration of the deliciousness of something based upon dissatisfaction that I'm nothing. So believing that when I get the cake, it'll make me happy. So that's the heart job of it. It over-exaggerates something out there and then believes that when I get it, I'll get happy. That's its heart job, but it's multifaceted. It's the dissatisfaction energy. It's the never-ending conceptualizing, fantasizing, thinking if this and if that and maybe this and maybe that, all the nonsense in our head. All our fantasy activities, like if you're sitting there having a sexual fantasy, that's attachment energy. You're thinking about daydreaming about your new boyfriend, that's attachment energy. If you're watching video games, which is completely, exactly a sophisticated presentation of conceptuality of attachment. When you're watching pornography, when you watch a movie, when you write a novel, when you do anything creative, that's a function of attachment energy that's super creative and super conceptual. So if that's really just gross level, then you become like an animal. If it's more sophisticated, like Bach, he's got super attachment energy, creativity, but it's mixed with, you know, a higher level of virtue and helping others. It's a primordial state of mind. All the overthinking we do, that's attachment. All the anxiety, worrying about this, and if only that, and maybe this, and why not, that's attachment. It's all attachment. It's primordially deep and multifaceted attachment. Do you understand?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
Yeah.
Did you recognize anything I said?
Well, that whatever I think moment by moment in this way of the anxiety, it might be related to be attached to me, which...
What? Now you're making me confused. What are you saying?
I don't know how to explain it. I'm sorry.
You're describing a certain state of your own mind, are you?
Sorry?
Are you describing a certain state of your mind, are you?
Yes.
What are you calling it? What's the name you're giving it?
Anxiety.
Okay, how would you describe anxiety?
Like being preoccupied of things.
With what?
With things that might happen that are not really happening.
Okay, good, good. There you go. That's attachment. Attachment has a function of always wanting something more. Attachment has the function of never being satisfied with what you've got. Attachment has the function of looking into the past and wishing if only this and if only that. Attachment has the function of imagining something and looking forward to it. Attachment has the function of fearing that something might or might not happen. It's all the function of attachment, and each of us has a different way of expressing it. Some people just attach to cake and eat all day and not anxious. Some people are attached to getting exactly what they want and will be like a fierce vampire to get what they want. There's multitudes of ways it functions, and the way you're talking is a classic way. Worrying, imagining all the things that might happen. This is the one that makes us absolutely insane. That's attachment, darling. Yes, of course it is. So what do you think the solution is? What's one solution, do you think?
Practice Mahamudra?
No. Forget it. Keep it more simple. What's a day-to-day function? What's a day-to-day? You know, I mean, I remember I had one woman on one of the courses here, and she was talking about how she was anxious all the time that her husband might die. That was her particular anxiety. So she said to me, how can I get my mind to be more relaxed? And I said, forget about making your mind more relaxed. Just how about deciding that it might happen and in fact he will die? So what is the thing you're anxious about? What's a bad thing to happen, is it? A bad thing, for example. Yeah. What, for example, I don't want to be personal, but what's the thing you worry about?
I don't know, that someone in my family might die.
Okay, good. There we go. Well, honey, you know what, Fernando? They will die. So get used to it. That's the way you cut straight to the chase. Instead of, oh, people say, oh, no, they won't die. Don't be ridiculous. They will die, Fernando. So start getting used to it. So what are you going to do if you recognize they're going to die? What's your solution then? What's your action point? Right now, I tell you, they will die. What's your action point? What will you do right now?
To accept that it will happen.
Thank you. And then get on with the life and be kind to them and loving and use it as an example, knowing that they're impermanent, and be kind every second. You make the most of it. And if you get up tomorrow morning and they're still there, it's a bonus. Get used to it. Impermanence is the way life is, Fernando.
Okay.
So that cuts right through the fear. It will happen. They will die, baby, and so will you. So get used to it and start practicing and not wasting your life. That's my answer. How about that?
Yes, I will.
Make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Get bloody mindfulness and accepting it. Just, this is reality, honey. God almighty. Then there's no fear. Then you make the most of your life. You be kind to them right now. You practice virtue right now, because you're going to die.
Yes.
That's, for me, the best way to stop anxiety. Right there, boom, and get on with your life. Get on the earth, please. Stop living in your head. I mean, I'm being a bit rough, but get my point.
Yeah. Okay.
Forget Mahamudra. Just be practical, be natural, get on with it. They're going to die, baby, and your house will burn down, and you're going to die, and you might get killed. Anything will happen, but stop thinking about it. Just live your life, and then when it does come, you'll be ready for it. That's the point. Live right now, this second, and do what you can right now, and then if it does happen, you'll be ready for it. But thinking of it happening is like, it's like insanity.
Okay.
Do you understand?
Yes, I do.
They will die, and you will die. So what are you going to do about it? Start practicing right now. And have a happy mind. I know it's easy to say, but it's a very powerful one.
Okay.
Don't think about what will happen. That's what people, I mean, you know, that's what our minds are insane. Oh, go down and buy me a pint of milk. Well, what if I crash on the way? That's how we live like this. It's demented. You understand? You might crash. Meanwhile, be careful. And if you crash, you'll be ready for it. Your mind will be more clear. And you'll handle it. Life is impermanent. Unless you're clairvoyant, you don't know what's going to happen. It's not meant to make us scared. It's meant to make us wake up and be trying to deal with what's arising right now and do your best right now, every second, Fernando, right now. Practice kindness, practice wisdom, do your practice every day, be kind to your beloveds, be kind to, you know, understand what's going on, understanding karma, and just live every day with the long-term goal in mind, of course.
Okay.
You understand, sweetheart?
Yes, I do.
Good. Okay. What else, people? Maybe we should finish on that point. I don't know.
Yeah, no more questions.
No more questions? Any more questions from anybody? It went so quickly today. It didn't go so quickly, doesn't it? No time to waste. Do you have a sense of enthusiasm? Who is that?
Who's Glenn.
Where? Who?
Glenn.
Me. I can't see you.
Hi.
Oh, there you go. Hi, sweetheart. Talk to me. Good.
So when we have all the negative, the dirt that comes up, and then we become very angry, so at that moment in time, we're also building new karma.
Darling, in every second that your mind is experiencing something is the fruit of a past seed. Everything your mind is doing now is sowing a new seed. So given that, what's the question?
When I have all this dirt coming up. How, and then I'm getting very angry. How do I keep myself from, I don't know how to explain it. Like,
okay, Lynn, listen to me. There's two things. My friend, the meditator, right, working on his mind, doing 3-year retreats, 4-year retreats, the one I mentioned before, right? And so there's two different things going on. Okay, there's two things going on. Because he's doing all this purification, all these retreats, he's observing all this craziness arising in his mind. The rational, clear part of him today doesn't want to be angry, doesn't want all that, but it's almost like he can't stop it. That's not being angry. The vomit is coming up from the past. So then your wisdom and your intelligence is observing it, and you're knowing, I don't want to buy into this anger, but look at it. And then you think of it as purification, but don't buy into it. Then it's not being angry. It's purifying. It's like this. Let's say I'm your friend, and you come to me, you're crying with anger, and you're blaming your boyfriend. He's evil, he's this, he's that, and that's called getting angry. And I agree with you. So that means I've just helped you increase your anger. But what if you come to me instead, and you're angry, and you're fearful about your anger, and you want to understand your own anger? You don't want the anger, so you talk to me about it with the wish to try and help you change. That's not anger. That's purification. So don't be scared of our mind. Just because a thought arises doesn't mean, and that's why Mahamudra, just observing your thoughts is so powerful, and not having an opinion about it. Let it come and let it go. Observe its anger. But as soon as you don't buy into it, you can't be creating karma. But if you buy into it, then it becomes imprints in your mind. So be brave.
So try to observe, basically.
As much as you can. And that's why the starting point is shut the mouth. Control your mouth, baby. Don't vomit it out of the mouth. And then try to work on the mind. It's not comfortable. It's not comfortable seeing our mind. We don't want it because we feel over when we feel guilty and ashamed as well. We have to be brave. Do you understand?
Yes.
And that's why to do the purification practice at the end of every day is so powerful. Do you understand, Lynn?
Yes.
Good
Thank
job.
You.
All right. So I think it's enough for today. Enough shouting and yelling. Be brave, everybody. Want to see your mind. And if you're an ordinary samsaric person, join the universe, okay? That means Buddha's model of the mind refers to all beings in the universe, all the dogs and animals as well. It's his fundamental model of the universe. It's very powerful. So we want to see our mind. We want to see what's there, but it's always within the framework of knowing our marvelous potential. If when you go to the gym, if you're going and you just have pain every day, but your body never changes, that's a stupid thing to do, isn't it? But you go to the gym and you put up with the pain and the diet because you're aiming towards a beautiful body. If there's no beautiful body at the end of that pain, you're insane. Stop going to the gym. It's the same here. The only reason you want to look at your mind, the only reason you want to see the anger and the pain and the anxiety is because it's in the framework of getting rid of it and seeing your own amazing potential. Buying into the blissful nature of your own mind, and then so you can have compassion so that you can help others. That's the long term. When you have that long term, you have much courage and you want to work on your mind and you want to practice and you want to take responsibility for what's there. You're so happy to own it, you know. So it's got to get the right perspective, people. In big picture, your own amazing potential. We have to not forget that. That's how you have to. We're so limited in our view of who we really are in our own culture, you know. So be brave, everybody. See you all tomorrow. Jangchob Semchog Rinpoche. Makye Panam Kye Gyo Chig. The second one. Jangchob Semchog Rinpoche. Makye Panam Kye Gyo Chig. Kye Panyam Pa Mepa Yang Gong Ne Gong Du. May this amazing bodhicitta, this aspiration to help others, that has not come into anybody's minds, may it come in the mind. And that those who have it in their mind, may it never finish it. So amazing on this planet, you know. Very special. Never give up. Okay. Thank you, precious ones. Bye. Thank you for having me, everybody. See you tomorrow, some of you. Much love.
Yeah.
Bye, sweethearts.
Thank you. Love you.